This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. The recession has hit many Americans hard. For those who haven't felt the impact, a new computer game can drop you into a life of barely getting by.
The game wasn't ever trying to literally perfectly reflect the experience of somebody living on the edge. What it was supposed to do was give someone playing the emotional experience of being on the edge. That feeling that no matter what you do, you can't get ahead.
And in Egypt, the military council announces emergency law will end before elections in September. For people who've suffered under the law, it's not a moment too soon.
I had a really hard time. I mean, I was electrocuted in sensitive places. They kept me naked for 2 days, and it was really cold at that time. It was February.
Plus, baseball and bachata from the Dominican Republic. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. The ruling Military Council of Egypt announced last week that it would lift emergency law before the parliamentary elections scheduled for September. The emergency law is widely hated as it gives the government sweeping powers to arrest people without charge, detain prisoners indefinitely, and use special military courts. Since the February Revolution, the transitional government run by the military has released almost 2,000 prisoners, but the law is still in place. By some estimates, there are still thousands of people held under the emergency law in Egypt's prisons, among them democracy activists, bloggers, and members of Islamic groups. Reporter Bonnie Allen introduces us to one prisoner's family and its struggle to free a father.
These are all documents for my father's case.
Abdurrahman Al-Jakali points to a thick stack of papers on his dashboard.
Some of them from Amnesty International, others from the United Nations.
So you've had these on your dashboard for years?
Well, I have to keep them here because they have to be in front of me. I keep these as a base.
This is Al-Jakali's office, a beat-up old car that spits out smoke as it zigzags through Cairo's congested streets. Behind the wheel, Al-Jakali is consumed by one thing.
Since the fall of the regime, I've been trying every day for his release, for my father's release.
Al-Jakali's father, Mohammed, has been in prison for 16 years without charges. The courts in Egypt have repeatedly ordered his release, but state security refuses to let him go free. They're very bad people, says Mohammed by telephone from prison. Mohammed Al-Jakali was first arrested in 1981 after the assassination of Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat. That's when Hosni Mubarak took office and imposed emergency law. Egypt's police began arbitrarily arresting thousands of Islamists in a campaign to fight terrorism. Mohammed, who maintains he has no link to any terrorist group, spent almost 4 years in prison. When he was released, he left Egypt and moved his family to Pakistan. But in 1995, Mohammed was extradited to Egypt and thrown back in prison. He says it's because he did a television interview criticizing Hosni Mubarak. He's been in prison for 16 years, never tried or convicted of any criminal activity. That's what keeps his son, Al-Jakali, fighting to free his father.
Because he was innocent. There is nothing against him. If there was anything against him, they could have tried him.
Right over there, the administration office.
We arrive at a tall government building. Al-Jakali has an appointment with the administrator in charge of prisons. He's nervous. Since the revolution, Al-Jakawi's been feeling more hopeful.
It's pretty different now because before they never let anybody inside, actually.
So you've never had this opportunity to talk
never.
To them face to face?
No, never.
Still, he wants me to stay outside. He's afraid bringing a journalist will cause trouble. 5 years ago, when Al-Jakali first complained publicly to human rights groups that his father was being tortured in prison, he was arrested in broad daylight and detained for 3 weeks.
I had a really hard time. I mean, I was electrocuted in sensitive places. I was cuffed all the 21 days, blindfolded. They kept me naked for 2 days. And it was really cold at that time. It was February.
On this day, after meeting with prison officials, Al-Jakali moves on to the public prosecutor's office. Several hours later, he's tired and frustrated. There is still no pledge to release his father. We walk to his grandmother's apartment. It smells of cat litter, and as we enter, several scrawny pets scatter in all directions. An elderly woman, cloaked in black, sits watching Turkish soap operas. Habiba hasn't left the apartment since her son was imprisoned 16 years ago. When I try to ask her a question, she can only cry and wheeze. For Al Shakawi, who's 30 years old, it's a heavy burden. He's been the head of the family since he was 14, caring for his mother, his six younger brothers and sisters, and his grandmother, all the while pleading for his father's release. The demonstrations in Tahrir Square, which continue as weekly rallies, have given Egyptians a chance to voice their frustration with Egyptian law.
Emergency law, it doesn't give the freedom of opinion or suit to Egyptian people, you know, because they will be afraid of arresting by police.
Egypt's interim military rulers have pledged to lift emergency law and release all political prisoners. But counter-terrorism organizations warn the jails also contain al-Qaeda-affiliated militants who have committed crimes. The ministry in charge of prisons declined an interview, but said prisoner cases are currently being reviewed. 2 days later, I receive a call from Al Shakawi. His father has just been released. I rush over to his grandmother's apartment. It's filled now with family and food.
This is my father.
Very nice to meet you.
Mohammed, who's 61, can barely walk. His brown beard has turned mostly white and it hangs down his chest.
Yes, I'm happy, but not so happy. Because I'm ill and I have suffered so much and affect my health.
Al Shakawi lifts his father's leg to expose ugly scars.
This area was totally, it was full of pus.
They tortured me severely. I suffered some cracks in my chest.
He got his ribs broken.
And they give me some electric shocks.
Mohammed maintains his innocence and praises Allah for his freedom, and his mother Habiba cannot stop smiling. Later that night, after the celebration, Al Shakawi gets back in his car to drive home. He's still a bit stunned.
It's something that was impossible, and just within days or within weeks, it all happens, so it feels amazing.
And for the first time in 16 years, he can start thinking about his own future. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Cairo, Egypt.
In the country where the reform movement began, the interim government of Tunisia has now set a date for elections there. This comes after weeks of demonstrations calling for a faster transition to democracy. And so, on July 24th, Tunisians will be voting on who they want to draft their new constitution. While Tunisians celebrate this step toward democracy, many worry justice is lagging behind as thousands of victims of corruption wait for their day in court. Megan Williams reports from Tunis.
On the third floor of a tall government building in downtown Tunis, two middle-aged men and a woman sit anxiously, holding documents on their laps. This is the waiting room for the newly formed Anti-Corruption Commission. And those waiting are here to lodge complaints against the former regime of President Ben Ali. He and his wife headed a kind of kleptocracy for decades, until they were chased out of the country during the popular uprising. I ask this man in the corner what brings him here today. He tells me his name is Monji Ben Ali Trabelsi. His problem is with the former president's in-laws. They were infamous for grabbing anything they wanted from private citizens, cars, businesses, homes, whatever. He says Ben Ali's in-laws bought property next door to him. When he refused to sell them his land, they took it by force.
I've been trying to get my land back since 2009. They told me if I wanted it back, I'd have to pay $100,000 for it. I got a lawyer, but it did no good.
So now he's turning to the new Anti-Corruption Commission for help. The transitional government set up the commission about 2.5 months ago. Its scope is fact-finding, to determine if corruption took place, and if so, to pass the cases brought here to the Justice Department. Already, more than 5,000 people have filed complaints. The man who has to deal with them is Abdel Fateh Amour. His office is just across the hall.
Bonjour, merci. Enchanté.
Amour sits behind a long desk stacked with files. He says corruption poisoned every facet of life in Tunisia under the Ben Ali regime.
La douane, le domaine immobilier.
From import-export taxes to banking regulations to permits for markets.
Il y a beaucoup d'attentes. Les gens ont été brimés.
Expectations are huge now. People were denied justice for a very long time. So now it's as if a pressure cooker exploded. People want justice right away, instantly.
Amour says his work is being undermined by members of the old regime who still hold key positions in the government.
Il y a différentes choses. D'abord,
we've been the object of daily harassment, destabilization attempts, and even threats. There are many at all levels who would like the Anti-Corruption Commission to fail or even disappear.
Back out in the waiting room, I get a taste of how much time and hope people are investing in the process. Tunisians are coming here with all sorts of problems, not just corruption. Through my translator, Salma, I hear the story of Hafida Balte. She's 53, though the deep worry lines on her face make her appear much older. She tells us her husband is disabled and they're living in a garage. For years, she's been asking different government agencies to provide her a room with electricity and running water. She says she's come to the Anti-Corruption Commission out of desperation. It's her last hope. The final person waiting, a heavy mustached man, motions us over to tell us his story. His name is Zamazi Messaoud Ladaisi, and he says he ran a successful discount electronics shop until about 3 years ago. That's when a corrupt local official made him sign over his store and all its contents.
They beat me and they even put me in jail. They left me nothing. After, I petitioned the president, Ben Ali, 5 times for justice, and nothing was ever done.
Like the others here, Ladaisi wants back what he says is legally his.
I just want to run my store. I have nothing left and no way to make a living.
Ladaisi also wants justice, something this whole generation of Tunisians is waiting for. For the World Vision Report, I'm Megan Williams in Tunis.
The baseball season started last week, and coming up, we look at some of the baseball hopefuls for whom the game is much more than sport. That's ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. Baseball season is upon us. Playing in the major leagues is not just the dream of young boys in the U.S. In countries such as the Dominican Republic, it's seen as a way out of poverty. That has long been the case, but now a new facet. New York Times reporter Michael Schmidt discovered that U.S. investors are in effect gambling on the prospects of young Dominican boys who hope to become star players. Michael Schmidt joins us by phone from Iraq, where he's now on assignment. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thanks.
Well, Mike, many players have been recruited from the Dominican Republic over the years, Sammy Sosa, Manny Ramirez, just a couple on that long list. But you traveled down to the Dominican Republic and found something else has been developing over the past few years. What did you find?
Investors from the United States have gone down to the Dominican Republic and are financially backing local trainers. And in exchange for this, the investors are taking significant cuts of the players' signing bonuses, these teenage players, when they sign with American teams.
Well, how profitable is that for the investors? What kind of money are we talking about here?
Well, what happens is that these investors go down there with several hundred thousand dollars, and they give money to these local trainers so they can work with these teenage players. And what happens is when the players get to be 16, 17, 18 years old, they sign contracts with major league teams, which can be for millions and millions of dollars. And those cuts can be as high as 50%. And for the American investors, they believe this is a very lucrative way of making money. But on the other hand, there are critics of this who believe that these investors are taking advantage of poor children down there who aren't even going to school.
How young are they when they're entering these baseball academies, as they're called?
Oh, some are as young as 13, 14, 15 years old.
Well, what was in place before this infusion of American investors?
Well, what's happened over the past two decades, and more significantly over the past 5 years, is that the amount of money players have received in signing bonuses has gone up significantly. And as the signing bonus numbers went up, investors from the state saw this as an opportunity to cash in and went into the market, and they helped the poor Dominican trainers who didn't have a lot of money. They helped them run their academies, their daily costs. They gave them cash to do that. In exchange for that, they were able to claim the money that their players were making.
This is legal?
We believe it's legal. Nothing in our reporting showed that it was illegal. Internationally, there's questions about whether this is trafficking. It doesn't quite rise to human trafficking. But I guess the bottom line on this is that this would not be going on in the United States, because there's a far different system in the United States, and there's far fewer poor baseball players that the investors can get their hands on.
So you visited a couple of these baseball academies. Take us through there. What were they like? What were the conditions?
Well, the conditions range. You know, one academy that we visited was a small house for their kids to live in, and in this small home, there was dozens of kids living. And there was no doors on some of the bedrooms, and some of the kids were sleeping with nets over their beds because they were afraid of insects, and it was dirty, and these conditions were pretty rough.
Are they getting an education in something other than baseball there?
One academy has English training where they teach the players baseball words in English, but there's not really much education beyond that. So some go to school, but not many of them. So you have a large excess of these young people that don't have skills and have difficulty finding work.
What kind of reaction did you get from this story, from those in Major League Baseball?
Well, people in baseball sort of raised their eyebrows about this because they said they didn't know much about it. And they thought it was kind of troubling. Advocates for kids down there, they found it to be exploitive. You know, that's sort of the biggest reaction that we got. And the people that we wrote about, you know, didn't call us and say, you know, you portrayed us unfairly. You know, they were very sort of comfortable with how they were portrayed. So, I don't know.
Is there a sense that these academies create a bigger pool of players coming to the majors from the Dominican Republic, or is this absorbing those kids who were likely to be recruited anyway?
That's a good question. My guess is that these players would have been recruited anyway, and it's just sort of a different way of training the players.
Where do you see this going from here?
I think that the American investors will continue to be in the Dominican market until either the government says you can't be here or they find better places to put their money.
Well, Michael, thank you for joining us to talk about this today.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Schmidt is a reporter with the New York Times. He joined us from Baghdad, Iraq, where he is now reporting. From baseball to bachata. That's the style of music that developed in the early part of the 20th century in poor rural communities of the Dominican Republic. For decades, bachata was looked down upon as being too melancholy. Some might even have called it rustic, perhaps because many of the lyrics were about poverty. But around about the 1980s, the music became more polished and a little more pop. Fast forward to these days, bachata's at the top of the charts with a song called Ay Ay Ay, sung by Anthony Santos. Ay, ay, ay. Que se demuestra That was Anthony Santos from the Dominican Republic. The recession is hitting a lot of people hard, and not always in obvious ways. Some of the formerly unemployed have managed to find jobs, but often the pay is lower, or they don't have health insurance. Imagine if this was your situation. You're getting by, but just barely, and then something happens, maybe a car accident, and you have to pay the bill. Suddenly, you can barely make ends meet. Patrice Nelson knows the story well. She sees it unfold in her town every day. Nelson is director of the Urban Ministries of Durham, North Carolina, which serves people who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. She says the number of people coming to the food pantry has doubled in just the past year. Nelson had the idea that if more people better understood just how easy it is to end up homeless, they might be willing to donate more to groups like hers. She says she loved the idea suggested by the advertising company McKinney, a computer game called Spent. The World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber visited Durham and produced this story.
Hi, I'm Patrice Nelson. I'm Executive Director of Urban Ministries of Durham.
I'm Jenny Nicholson. I'm a copywriter at McKinney, a national advertising agency based in Durham, North Carolina.
Over 14 million Americans are unemployed. Now imagine you're one of them. Your savings are gone, you've lost your house, you're a single parent, and you're down to your last $1,000. Can you make it through the month? That's the challenge in the game Spent. I'm going to play and find out what happens. The first thing I have to do is find a job.
I think one of the things that made me want to make Spent is that when I was growing up, we didn't have any money. We were extremely poor. And now I work at a national advertising agency. I make a good living. I have a house. I have a car. And even though I lived those things growing up, my day-to-day reality now is so far from that that sometimes even I have a hard time kind of really understanding deep in my heart the realities of what people are living through right now. And I lived it.
Money may be tight, but I still need to eat, the game is telling me, and so it's time to go shopping. These groceries need to last a few weeks, and so I have to choose wisely. What do I want to buy? Let's see. Can of beans, pretty cheap. Let's see, I'll buy a few of those. Buy some spaghetti.
I remember when I was a kid going to the grocery store and not having enough money to pay for our groceries and having to decide right there at the checkout counter with people waiting in line behind you what you were going to put back. And that may not be as sort of immediately when you think of it a big deal as not having enough money for food at all, but that's psychologically and emotionally, that's has a big impact.
I'm down to $340. My tooth has been hurting for weeks and it's starting to get unbearable. I need a root canal, but I don't have dental insurance. So what do I want to do? I can get it fixed for $400. I don't have $400, or I can use some numbing gel. I think at the moment I'm going to have to take the numbing gel.
I got a call from a business owner in Minnesota who said that, you know, he had started a business 15 years ago and he was living the American dream. And he and his wife had invested everything they had into this business. And in 2008, they ran into trouble and the business went bankrupt. They've lost their home. They've lost their health care. He talked about his wife having a small accident and having to go to the emergency room and trying to negotiate to be able to pay $15 a month. And he called to say just how the game reflected what he was living. And he just wished more people could understand that it can happen to people like him.
I'm driving with my kid in the back seat when my car slips on a slick stretch of road and slides into a parked car, causing a big dent in the bumper and a broken taillight. I can pay the damage, which is $550, or I can drive away. I only have $287 in the bank. I guess I have to drive away.
There are times when you have to make ethical choices that you really don't want to make, but because of your financial situation, you end up making choices that you don't really feel good about.
A lot of people who play the game are like, this has got to be the worst month ever. You know, because in the course of a month, to fit in all of the sort of challenges that are faced, it is exceptionally a bad month. But the thing that I always say is that, you know what, people have months like this. And if it isn't a month like this over 2 months or 3 months, that really is the experience. And I think the way I think about it is that the game wasn't ever trying to literally perfectly reflect the experience of somebody living on the edge. What it was supposed to do was give someone playing the emotional experience of being on the edge, that feeling that no matter what you do, you can't get ahead.
So my landlord found out that I have a pet, and now I have to pay a $350 pet fee. Okay, let's see. I could pay the fee, I can take my pet to the animal shelter, or I can ask a friend to take my pet. I can't afford the fee, and I don't want to take my pet to the shelter. But if I ask a friend for help, it'll post to my Facebook page.
A lot of people say that they don't use that option. They say, I know it was just a game. I know I'm not really asking my friend if I can stay on their couch because I got evicted. But they said, I couldn't do it. I couldn't push the post button because it was too embarrassing or too shameful or too uncomfortable for them. And so for me, whether they share it or not, that experience is exactly what we were hoping to get.
My father actually ended the game with more money than he started. He ended the game with $1,300. But he had not paid any of his bills, had terrible teeth, had not done any of these great things for his kids. And over time, you start to think through, what would it be like to make those kind of choices on a regular basis? And in the end, you'll still be spent.
As for me, I made it through the month with some money in the bank, $284. But rent's due tomorrow. It's $740, and I can't pay it. If I were the single parent character in this game, my kid and I might soon be out on the street.
That was the World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber. In the first 6 weeks that the game was online, more than 400,000 people played it, some from as far afield as England, Brazil, and South Africa. So far, the Urban Ministries of Durham has received more than $10,000 in donations, and the game is being used as a teaching tool in schools and universities. To check it out, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. It's almost tomato time. Summer is tantalizingly close for those who enjoy buying their produce from farmers markets or growing their own. Seeking out and eating locally grown food has become a trend in the U.S., but in hundreds of small agricultural towns across Argentina, that's the way it's always been. For our What's Cooking segment, reporter Marcos Federman traveled to the town of Dugan, 90 miles outside Buenos Aires, to see what one farmer does with his tomato crop.
It's a stormy day in Dugan, but the wind and rain doesn't stop Chino, as Juan Doval likes to be called. It's tomato season, and Chino will spend the day patiently dehydrating dozens of tomatoes in his mud oven. Adobe ovens are central to daily life in Argentinian countryside. The native Guarani tribe calls them tatacua, which means cave of fire. Whatever is cooked in this kind of oven is permeated with a rich, smoky flavor. Chino begins the process by lighting the fire. Chino says it takes about 40 minutes for the oven to get hot enough. In the meantime, he starts chopping ripe, red plum tomatoes.
Porque cortamos los tomates a la mitad.
We cut the tomatoes in half, take off the tip, and scrape out the pulp with a spoon. Then we put all our tomato halves on a big platter, with the peel side down. After that, we sprinkle some salt, sugar, pepper, olive oil, oregano, or basil, and any other herbs you like, and straight to the oven. Or like my grandma used to say, to the oven we go.
The tomatoes are ready to cook, but what about the oven? Chino uses his hand as a thermometer.
You should be able to keep your hand inside the oven for about 6 or 7 seconds until it burns a little. Basically, the oven shouldn't be too hot, so the cooking is slow. We'll leave the tomatoes in there for about 3 hours.
Chino says that smoke needs time to do its job. The longer the tomatoes cook, the better they'll taste. He says the key is listening.
The tomatoes shouldn't make a lot of crackling noise. You know the temperature is right when there's almost no sizzle.
Chino is in his mid-30s. He was born and raised in Dugan. His father was a farmer, and Chino grew up plowing the land and planting crops.
Dugan is a nice place to live because we're only 500 people here. Most of us plant corn, soy, some have cattle. My neighbor raises pigs, and I have to listen to their screams every once in a while. He trades me half a pig for several jars of smoked tomatoes. We barter a lot in this town.
Chino takes me proudly to see what's in his refrigerator. Pork, eggs, chicken, and milk, all given to him in exchange for his vegetables and smoked tomatoes. His tomatoes are famous around here, but they're not for sale. He only trades them or gives them as gifts. About 3 hours have passed. We've talked about vegetables, life on the farm, bartering, and the taste of smoke. Finally, it's time, and I follow Chino back to his adobe oven. Chino says he knows the tomatoes are done by their consistency, about 70% dehydrated, but still juicy. He puts them in jars and covers them with oil. The jars go in the refrigerator for 3 weeks.
During this time, all the flavors blend, from tomato to oil and from oil to tomato. Everything meshes and reaches its full flavor intensity. After 3 weeks, they're ready to go.
As I say goodbye, Chino hands me a jar of his best tomatoes. I have nothing to trade with him, but he says that's okay. The tomatoes are in exchange for being good company. For the World Vision Report, I'm Marcos Federman in Dugan, Argentina.
Coming up, we introduce you to Hannah Slocum, a Liberian who spent her life helping others to make a living. That's ahead on the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, and this is the World Vision Report. A little over a decade ago, the Bolivian government joined forces with multinational organizations to privatize the water supply in the city of Cochabamba. The local community took to the streets protesting new regulations that would make water unaffordable for the city's poor. Some claimed that under the proposed law, people would need a license even to collect rainwater from their roofs. And that's where the title of the new Spanish feature film, También la Lluvia, or Even the Rain, comes from. The film is about an unsuspecting movie crew that comes to Cochabamba in the days leading up to the water war. Rachel Clift has this review.
Even the Rain doesn't waste a second of screen time. The moment it starts, we're plunged into the middle of organized chaos on a street in Cochabamba. It's the year 2000. An endless line of Bolivian men, women, and children stand under a blazing sun while an anxious young film director scrutinizes the crowd, looking for extras. Desperate for work, these folks aren't going anywhere without an audition. We'll see all of you, he says, no matter how long it takes. Gael Garcia Bernal plays Sebastian, an idealistic Spanish director making an ambitious movie about Spain's brutal conquest of the Americas. Sebastian and his crew are shooting in Bolivia because it's the cheapest country in South America with the largest indigenous population. The movie's producer, Costa, is thrilled with how little they're able to pay the local actors, including an outspoken man named Daniel, whom they've cast in the role of indigenous leader. Sebastian and Costa begin filming in the hills above town, while just a few miles away, a battle over water rights is erupting in the streets, and their star, Daniel, is leading the protest. And so the film within a film unfolds, allowing screenwriter Paul Laverty to explore the past and present at the same time. Mostly it works, with the exception of a few heavy-handed moments. During a lunchtime reading of the script, the Spanish actor who plays Christopher Columbus suddenly channels his character.
Oro. ¿Dónde está el oro? Ya sabes a qué me refiero, mujer. Oro.
Where is the gold? He screams at a stunned indigenous waitress.
¿Dónde está?
The symbolism hits us over the head like a small brick. Even the rain is as much about the living legacy of colonialism as it is about historical fiction. As the water conflict becomes increasingly violent, the Spanish cast and crew, who once enjoyed lively political debates over bottles of wine, now face an ethical dilemma. Do they stay and finish the film, or abandon the project and go home, leaving their Bolivian friends to suffer the consequences of the uprising alone? Movies about making movies tend to be satirical. They're usually sprinkled with insider jokes, and they often poke fun at the shallow obsessions of the industry. Here, Laverty and director Ixtiar Bolén use the device to confront deeper questions about imperialism, human rights, and the sometimes exploitative nature of filmmaking. That's a lot for viewers to process, but we're willing to try, with help from dynamic characters struggling to decide how far they'll go to stand up for what they believe in. Laverty has dedicated the film to Howard Zinn, the progressive historian who passed away last year. Zinn revealed the brutality of the real Columbus in his groundbreaking book, A People's History of the United States. But he also understood that the personal is political, and that the choices we make today will reverberate for generations to come.
Even the Rain is now playing in theaters nationwide. Rachel Clift is a writer and producer living in Brooklyn, New York. By every measure, the West African country of Liberia is one of the world's worst places to be a woman. In the aftermath of a brutal civil war, women have limited access to medical care, jobs, and education. Rape is so common that many women don't even know it's a crime. Most women raise children on their own on less than a dollar a day. But in one part of the country, women have made progress thanks to Liberian Hannah Slocum. Ma Hannah, as she's affectionately known, has made it her life's work to help lift Liberia out of poverty, one woman at a time. Prue Clark reports from Liberia.
At the end of a dirt track in Bay, a tiny village of palm trees and mud huts, women sing about love. Only with love, their song goes, can peace take hold. Life's been hard for these women. During 14 years of civil war, they lost children and husbands to hunger, fighting, disease. Even after the war ended 8 years ago, life looked bleak. But today there are smiles here. The woman they thank for their new lives is 59-year-old Hannah Slocum.
There aren't words to say how important she is.
Jenny Mars is 40 years old and a widow. Like women throughout this part of rural Liberia, she calls Slocum simply Ma Hannah.
She's my husband. She's my God. I have no mother, no father. She is everybody for me.
Hannah Slocum is a nurse. She was born in the nearby town of Kakata. It's where she now runs a women's health clinic. But Hannah does far more for the women of her region than just provide medical care. She helps them become self-sufficient, not an easy task in this destitute land. On this morning, Hannah is in Bay to check in with some of the women she's helped. She's also pressing them to register for the upcoming election. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first woman president, is running for a second term, and Slocum wants the women to support her.
Ma Ellen doing well. She's trying her best. So let us try to register to vote her back in for the second term. The work she got to do is plenty. She can.
Hannah Slocum first stepped foot in Bay 4 years ago. She found a village full of traumatized women, women like Jenny Mars.
My life was down.
My life was just down.
Mars was brutally raped during the war. Rebels also shot and killed her husband in front of her. Mars's injuries were so bad, it was 4 years until she could walk again. Her four children went days without food. Another villager, Julia Blama, watched two of her children and her parents die of starvation.
I lose hope at that time. I lose hope.
I lost hope at that time. I lost hope after my parents died. I thought I might not even make it.
Then came Hannah Slocum and her cassava machine. Here in the center of the village, under a large mango tree, children gather with Hannah to watch quietly as Jenny Mars washes cassava tubers to prepare them for the grinding machine. When Hannah arrived in Bay, her first task was to find a way for the women here to make a living. So she taught them to grow cassava more efficiently, and she brought them this machine to grind it. On this steamy morning, Jenny Mars starts the machine and piles half a dozen tubers into the feeding chute. The metal box has a grinder attached to a small motor. Out the other end comes a pulpy mass that's dried and sold as a kind of oatmeal.
I grind the cassava so we can sell it in the market.
What once took days by hand now takes 15 minutes. The women of Bay say that before Hannah came, they were lucky to earn $4 a month. Now they can make 50. Jenny jokes that many people here would like to see my Hannah run for president of Liberia.
Everybody would vote for her. The little baby, he would vote for her.
Hannah has done this same work for women in remote villages all across this part of Liberia. She's done it for 40 years. But it was during the war that she became legendary. Liberia's civil war was one of Africa's most brutal. It brought to power warlord Charles Taylor and his rebel army. Back at the Kakata clinic, Hannah picks up the story. Patients hang on her words. One day, says Hannah, she and her family came to a rebel checkpoint as they were fleeing the fighting. The checkpoint had become notorious as God Bless You Gate. If you passed through alive, it was said, God blessed you. A young rebel told Hannah to hand over a chicken she was carrying. Hannah was tired and hungry and refused. As the boy lifted his arm to hit Hannah, his commander intervened.
He said, oh, my Hannah. He called all the soldiers. He said, I know this lady. She saved me when I was in Kakata. I had pneumonia and she treated me. So y'all respect her.
The commander told Hannah to pull her family aside. All the refugees at the gate, most of them strangers, crowded around her.
At that junction, who I deny anybody? No. So everybody became my family. There I was able to save all those people.
And she's still saving lives. Her clinic offers prenatal care and family planning. And in an annex, Hannah has started another project, a small vocational school. On this afternoon, women are in the annex learning to sew on half a dozen donated machines. There are also classes in weaving, reading and writing. Hannah says she's still a long way from achieving all her goals. She wants more medical care, more vocational training, more opportunities for these women. This is the key, she says, to securing Liberia's future.
We the women have to take the lead in uniting each other, uniting our mind. Peace can come to the country through the women.
As Hannah watches, 40-year-old Molly Kohene spells her own name.
S-E-N.
Molly's also learned to weave cloth here, and now she earns enough to feed her children and send them to school. She says Hannah's done what she long thought impossible. She's given Molly her life back. In Kakata, Liberia, I'm Prue Clark for the World Vision Report.
This piece was produced by T.C. Bowley, a reporter with New Narratives, an American project supporting women journalists in Africa.
Yes.
More and more women are being trained to work on projects that benefit their own communities. It's becoming quite common in public health. This is how it works.
find local women who don't necessarily have much education, then train them to give basic maternal and infant health care, and reap the health benefits for pregnant women and newborn babies. Donald McNeil Jr. wrote about this for the New York Times.
This is emerging as one of the new trends in global health, that there's a growing body of evidence that if you find volunteers who work in villages and you give them a minimum amount of training. I mean, they don't have to have an enormous amount of education. They don't have to have the kind of training that you need in order to produce a registered nurse, anything like it. You can give them a few months training and then pay them a little bit of money and just have them in the villages to be able to give advice to women who are about to give birth, who are able to weigh children, who are able to take fevers and look at a list of symptoms and see what's most likely for the child to have, who are able to hand out things like mosquito nets, or safe birth kits, which have things like a clean razor for cutting the umbilical cord in them, who can, even if they can't deliver the shots themselves, who are able to tell mothers, look, it's important that you go in and get your child immunized against tetanus, against diphtheria, against polio, against all the things that the shots are now available for. That if you have village health workers like that, you can make a really big dent in infant mortality.
This has already had a huge impact. In Pakistan, researchers from a local university followed 50,000 households for 2 years. Some of these received assistance from lady health workers, and some didn't. Again, Donald McNeil Jr.
In the article I did recently in Pakistan, they show that where women were assigned to work, they had 21% fewer stillbirths and 15% newborn deaths. 15% fewer newborn deaths in those areas. It makes a substantial difference when you have people even with a modicum of education, and they are literate but not incredibly literate. I mean, that is, they can read, but they don't necessarily have a whole high school education, but they can make a big difference in giving good advice to people because they're local, they're trusted, and they've had some education themselves.
One other aspect of this, it's lady health workers. Is there a reason why this is women dispensing this information and not men?
Well, it's mothers who take care of children. And that phrase, lady health workers, is actually something they say in Pakistan. In Ethiopia, they are called community health workers, or CHWs. So the phrase varies from country to country. But very often they're women. And for the same reason that a lot of polio vaccinators are women. Particularly in Muslim countries, a man may not step over the threshold of the house and come inside the compound unless the husband or father is home. And so if you want somebody to go in and vaccinate kids or go in and weigh the babies or check them for fever or give advice, it has to be a woman. She's less threatening. Also, she's had babies herself. I mean, ideally, she's had babies herself, so she is more empathetic with the woman of the house that she's trying to talk to. So it tends to work out better.
That was Donald G. McNeil, Jr. He's a reporter for the New York Times. You can read more of his work at worldvisionreport.org. Wairimu Gitahi is a Kenyan woman. She's also a journalist. She believed she understood her continent until she moved to South Africa last year. There she found all of her previous assumptions about race and about identity were challenged. Here is her reporter's notebook.
I am an African woman. I was born and raised in the eastern part of the African continent. I am Kenyan. I am black, if you insist that that is the color of my skin, though I think I'm dark brown. I can go on and on explaining my origins, and it would leave you with no doubt that I am unmistakably African. At least that's what I thought before I arrived in South Africa early this year. But my neat definitions have been called into question. The other day, I was invited for a barbecue, a favorite pastime for most South Africans, and a friend introduced me to another of her friends. As we chatted away, this lady referred to herself as colored. I was surprised by this comment. Eish, I would have sworn she's black. I thought being colored meant that one was a mixture of black and white origin. Black meaning from one of the ethnic South African groups, and white meaning Afrikaner. And speaking of white people, a few days after I'd arrived in Johannesburg, I was having a discussion with a couple of people in the media world. One of them, a white South African, asked me why I had chosen to come to South Africa to do further studies in journalism. I cleared my throat and boldly echoed the words of Mohamed Amin, a renowned African journalist. I think the African story is best told by Africans. I then went on to explain that sharpening my journalism skills would help me to do just that, tell the story of my people in a more objective way than Western journalists can. The man nodded thoughtfully for a moment and asked, "What does it mean to be African? Do you think I am African?" I didn't answer that question, but I've often thought about it since that day. As I travel around the country, I also see white people doing manual jobs, such as putting up billboards or pumping gas. It's not that I think white people are superior and shouldn't do such jobs, but what a surprise to see this happening in Africa. Yet nothing has caught my attention more than to see a white panhandler in the streets of Johannesburg. I'm in shock. In Africa? A white person begging? All these experiences have left me with more questions than answers. What is the meaning of race? Is race a culture, or the way one's physical features appear, or is it both? Is it a matter of social class? I've tried to ask my friends and acquaintances about all this, but I'm yet to find a uniform perspective. I've traveled to the US, Italy, Switzerland, and 7 African countries, but none has ever raised in me so many issues regarding race and class as South Africa has. This is a new Africa to me. I'm constantly redefining what it means to be African and to be in Africa. And now I'll never again take my old assumptions for granted.
Why Rimu Gitahi is a freelance documentary photographer and radio journalist from Kenya. And for this week, that's the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.